Amazing. Great.
Here we find ourselves. Back in Sesshin. How did we get here? Is this a mistake? Or is it perfect? No alternative this week. It was striking me this morning that it is amazing that the causes and conditions of the whole universe have brought us here to sit Sesshin. It's quite mysterious. It took a lot of causes and conditions to create this situation, this opportunity. Like the Big Bang, like Shakyamuni Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree a long time ago, and getting to the bottom of the matter. Took some devas to convince him to speak to others about what he understood, which he reluctantly and willingly did. It took 28 generations of Indian ancestors and a bunch of Chinese and Japanese ancestors. Trying to open to Buddha's way and convey that through so many years. It took Koban Chino Roshi landing in Santa Cruz. It took Jim Goodhue going to Japan to look for Buddha's way, and having a house on School Street that he needed to get rid of. He gave it to the Sangha. It took many, many practitioners to keep the practice going in this particular little location in the universe. To Sobun Catherine Thanis, steadily practicing here for 20 years. It took all of us arranging our lives to come here for this day or this week. It's not easy to get away for 7 days in the 21st century to come and do nothing, sit here. It took all those who grew the food and collected it, and the tenzo to cook it up and keep nourishing us, or we'd just keel over somewhere after a few days. It takes everybody playing their role each day in this very simple yet very elaborate ritual mandala we create called sesshin. Reflecting on all that, it strikes me as amazing that all that had to happen for us to be here now. And if it wasn't those conditions, it would have been some other conditions, and we would be somewhere else, or someone else would be somewhere else. Something would be happening somewhere. But this happening here with these particular beings had to happen just like this. An amazing opportunity, as that you know read this morning. This means an opportunity to discover anew, clarify, and actualize our deepest intention. We can look at the intentions that brought us to this session. It's a big part of the conditions for us being here. We could even go so far as to say that all that story just told of all those conditions and different people from the Big Bang onward was all just actually really just intentions, one intention after another, being expressed through body, speech, and mind, creating a physical, spiritual, and mind world. All of those are just unfolding of intentions. So we might have a story of why we came here, our intention. But I would guess that that's not really why we came here, whatever our story is. It's much faster than our idea of why we're here. And if we don't really know why, maybe we're a little closer to reality. Some people in this sangha just do all the sesshins. And they have the advantage of they don't have to think about, why am I doing this sesshin? Because it's just, well, I guess it's sesshin time again. I don't know why. Somehow it's just what we do. We can discover anew our deepest intentions. Which may be not the ones we think. You know, our intention might be like, well, I think it would be nice to have a really peaceful week. Or I'm a Zen practitioner and I haven't done sesshin for a while, so I probably should do one. Or it's the time to celebrate Buddha's enlightenment. Rohatsu sesshin. But our deepest intentions might be none of these. And it might not even be me and you that decided to do this. There's a Buddha working through us, calling us here. And more we clarify Buddha's intention, the more we can realize and actualize Buddha's intention. And then Sashin becomes more and more joyful. The more we are trying to, the more I am trying to do this Sashin and figure out how to practice here and what to do next and how to get through it and or how to get out of it now that I got into it, the more difficult it will be, the more I give up trying to do anything about this situation, the easier it becomes, the more joyful. So let Buddha do the sesshin for us. Was it Ellen who said that Koban used to talk about sesshin as time to die?
Yes.
Sesshin's time to die. So let the me who is going to get through sesshin, that one can just die. Not, you know, a violent death. just gently pass away. And let something really vast do the sesshin. Let the mirror awareness take care of the whole thing. And I and you are reflections on that mirror, so we can be there as reflected images. But that's all. Our deepest intention, Buddha's intention, Dogen expressed it. We just recited his deep intention, his vow. We can consider whether we resonate with these words. They don't have to be. Those words don't have to be our vow, but we can consider whether our intention is aligned with Dogen's vow. We vow with all beings because we can't separate ourselves from them. From this life on, throughout countless lives, this moment and every moment imaginable, we vow to hear the true Dharma. We vow to hear the true Dharma, which is not what we think it is. It's coming to us every moment, so vast, so all-pervading, so ungraspable, that it's very easy to not even notice it at all. We can vow to hear it each moment, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us. You say, well, I have some doubt about that. Like, what are you talking about anyway? This kind of inconceivable Dharma. But we vow that no doubt will arise in us. We have the intention that when doubt arises, we can look into it and see the groundless nature of the doubt, or I could say, if I think it's my doubt, then see how that, it's hard to find someone who actually has such doubt. It's hard to find the owner of the doubt. And the, we can, when we look and find no owner of the doubt, then it can, then it just becomes Buddha's doubt. And it's not such a hindrance. No doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. Trust that we can't do this. That I and you can't do this. Entrust our life to Buddha and let Buddha do it for us and for everyone. That upon meeting the true Dharma, we shall renounce worldly affairs. When we remember the vastness, we can let go of the smallness, the petty concerns that often dominate our lives, my life and your life, but that they don't, the concerns that don't dominate Buddha's life. Again, we can let them just be reflections on the mirror, these worldly affairs, and then maintain the Buddha Dharma. Again, if we think of, I have to maintain the Buddha Dharma, that responsibility is too great for me. It's impossible. I can't do it. You can't do it. What a like, what a frightening thought that I would have to maintain the Buddha Dharma. But Buddha can easily maintain the Buddha Dharma effortlessly. We can consider a vow, remember impermanence, the rare opportunity to just be alive this moment in this situation, and that it's quickly passing. Sesshin is almost 1/14 over already. That might not seem like so much, like it's going so quickly. But just wait.
I think there's a lot of sunlight shining on Hannah's face, and maybe if we blind him. It's hard for me to listen to Kokio watching this squint.
It was her halo. But it's, sometimes the radiance is too much. Yes. You're all experienced practitioners, not new to Sesshin. Michael maybe is his first Zen Sesshin, but he's a long-term meditator too. So you all know the practice. It's maybe not much to needs to be said. I suggested that we might have a Dharma talk with nothing said, called No Toys Sesshin. And I think we'll try it in the future. But sometimes there's words can be expressed. We can play with this joyfully, with the toy of a Dharma talk and some chanting and so on. One thought came to mind is, I don't know why, I guess all the causes and conditions of the universe came together, and the thought of Kodo Sawaki Roshi arose. Do you know Kodo Sawaki Roshi? Here we have some connection through Koban, our founder. I heard briefly met and practiced with Kodo Sawaki Roshi, who lived in the late 1900s in Japan, and kind of a renegade Zen teacher. Wasn't so into following the usual way of all the Zen ceremonies and the institution of Zen in Japan, but just really wanted to practice the way most directly. So he was a little outside the institution, but became very well known for his unusual, straightforward way. So we have this book, Living and Dying in Zazen, that's about Kodo Sawaki and his some of his students. Sawaki was a unique figure in modern Japanese Zen. He traveled the country running retreats and giving lectures. He spoke from his experiences as well as from his understanding of Buddhism, and he didn't pull his punches. One who studies the Zen of the Tang Dynasty, the golden age of Zen, might wonder what was so unusual about someone as outspoken as Sawaki. But the Zen world in modern-day Japan is not that of Tang China. Zen in modern Japan is part of an established religious sect in an affluent, rigidly hierarchical country. Many people have been attracted to Sawaki because of his uninhibited speech and somewhat eccentric manner. Having read so much about the artless Zen masters of old, they were excited to find someone in modern times who seem to be following in their tradition. That's a kind of introduction to Kodo Sawaki Roshi, homeless Kodo. He sometimes lived at temples, but he was called homeless Kodo because he never really hung around any temples for very long. He just wandered around. In his early days, He had kind parents, but he was named Saikichi when he was young. When he was 5 years old, his mother died. 3 years later, his father died. It's kind of extreme, huh? Sometimes that happens with Dogen was like that too. Yep, his parents died very young. The Buddha, his mother died right after he was born. It maybe helps these people to see how unreliable and impermanent this appearing world is. 3 years later, when his father died, the children were distributed among the relatives who were too poor to keep all the siblings together. Sawaki Roshi himself says, at first they wanted to send me to a temple, because you could do that to kind of like, if you didn't couldn't take care of the kid, send him to a Zen temple or some kind of Buddhist temple. But my aunt and uncle said, he's so mischievous that he'd never settle down in a temple. What's more, we have to make sure that when he grows up, he doesn't come back to us with a vendetta for sending him to a temple. So that's how it was seen, to send people to Buddhist temples. It was not like idyllic life, but who would want to go do that? You have no life. You just gotta like sit in the zendo again and again. So they decided against it. They eventually sent me to my aunt on my father's side. After a short period with his aunt and her husband, who actually would beat Saikichi every time his spoiled 4-year-old cousin Matsu decided to cry and blame his misfortune on Saikichi, he was again left parentless. So he eventually gets passed on to a distant relative who is a professional gambler and alcoholic, and he and his wife both gambled and just drank all day and night. So this is the atmosphere that little Saikichi was growing up in. At the age of 9, he was walking by a prostitute's quarters and saw a group of people gathered at the door. Having played hide-and-seek there many times before, he was quite comfortable going up to the second floor where the bedrooms were. There he saw the corpse of a man about 50 years old, a young prostitute around 17 or 18 in her night clothes, sitting by the bed with a disinterested look on her face, and a woman who appeared to be the dead man's widow crying by his side. "Even in death you're a disappointment," she was lamenting. "Why in this place, and for all the world to see?" So, little 9-year-old Saikichi was learning about life, learning about people not wanting to, people wanting to be seen a certain way, and about the unreliability of birth and death. Later, Sawaki Roshi says, "I realized then that people can't depend on keeping anything secret. And that's not all. His poor widow would be dishonored with each memorial service when she and others would be reminded that the dear departed had died in the bedroom of a young prostitute on the second floor of a whorehouse. There are many ways to contemplate impermanence. As a young child, I lost my mother and my father. My uncle then later collapsed in front of me and was dead within seconds. Still, I did not become keenly aware of impermanence. At those times, I just worried about who would raise me in the future." So even these, you know, 3 deaths when he was quite young, he's just like, well, okay, who's the next parent? I hope someone comes quick. Dogen, he says, lost his mother when he was 8 years old. It's said that seeing the smoke from the funeral incense rising awakened a sense of impermanence in him. People of lower realms like myself don't have that kind of experience. However, having vividly experienced sudden deaths, and finally on top of that, this one with the prostitute, I couldn't help but feel the reality of impermanence to the marrow of my bones. This time, Even one as dull as I couldn't avoid the heartfelt contemplation of impermanence. I experienced impermanence in this manner because of the environment in which I lived. The place where I was raised was the worst, the lowest of the low. There was absolutely no encouragement whatsoever to build character or to learn. But for that very reason, it turned out to be the best learning environment of all. Kodo Sawaki just taught in this very straightforward way. Here's just some Dharma teachings from his later life. He says, "Everyone in the world tries to make themselves important with their relationships and possessions. It's like trying to use the plate to give flavor to a flavorless dish. This is how the human world has lost sight of itself." So it's like, it's really some very bland, plain rice, but it's on a very nice Chinese decorated plate to kind of hopefully spiff up that plain dish. But it's kind of like a joke. So sometimes it can feel that way around here, right? We put on all these fancy robes and have a wonderful, beautiful hall, but does it really spiff up reality and who we are? We don't really need any of this stuff, but if we understand that we don't really need it, then it's okay. Because toys can be fun. And not just fun. I think we can see the forms of our practice as expressions. Expressions to convey some sincere heart. You know, at the same time, it's this fine line between an expression conveying a sincere heart and a colorful plate trying to make a bland dish tasty. It's maybe why Kodo Suwaki Hiroshi was maybe the founder of these no-toy sesshins. His disciple was Uchiyama Roshi, who maybe actually coined the term. He also said, "In religion or spirituality, there is no collective responsibility. It all depends on you." Interesting perspective. We can see both sides. We all co-create our practice life together. And yet if we're relying on others to do it for us, we might be waiting a long time. So I think this is coming from a very independent-minded person who grew up in a situation that forced him to be so. It all depends on you. Each one of us are relying on our own practice. But again, not me and you trying to do our practice. I don't think that's what he means by it all depends on you. It's not so much the collective. It's not so much you can rely on others, and you can't rely on the limited, small version of who you think you are, who I think I am, but you yourself, true Buddha, nature, coming through you in its own unique way, then we can rely on that. The basic practices of presence, relaxation, alertness, I think if we attend to these three, let Buddha attend to these three for this week, we may not go too far off track.
Say that again.
Presence, where Buddha lives, is right now. The more we start spinning into the past and the future, which is very easy to do, return to this present experience, here, now, presence, which we can, you know, there's many tools to cultivate presence, like following the breath, because the breath is never a past breath or a future breath, but any practice that will bring us into the present. And then relaxation, if we start to get uptight and anxious and tense, I think that's a really big one in Sesshin. Relaxation, like if we're trying too hard or getting too caught up in something, which is usually when we've lost presence, it's usually when it becomes not relaxing. They kind of go together. But relax, return to the present. And then if we're doing that, but we're actually getting, things are getting kind of really like hazy and dull, like, yeah, present, relaxed. It's just about 13 more half days like this. Then, so just, if we can just, it's like one long rest, one long nap, then we need the alertness part. So maybe kind of in that order. First, presence is like the basic underlying practice. And then if we start to try too hard or something and are not relaxed, then relaxed. But then if we get too overly relaxed and lose alertness, then we bring in the alertness. I think these three, whatever other practice we might be doing, these three are kind of working together. Then Buddha's work is easily done through this body and mind. Thank you all for giving your life to this strange event we call Sesshin. We're co-creating it. No one could do it alone, and yet it's up to each one of us. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.